From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Daniel Kushner, filling in for Evan Dawson.
Did you sleep last night in a pond? In a pond where the sun never shines. I wish you were all night too. Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone, but a cold wind blew. In a pond. In a pond where the sun never shines, I wish you were all night too.
Our connection this hour is a chance to nerd out about music, specifically cover songs and why they matter. When a musician sets out to perform or record another artist's song, that new version can be easy to ignore or dismiss as inferior to the original. And while many covers are mere copies and offer few new revelations, musically or lyrically, new interpretations can also be transcendent, introducing the song to new audiences and providing more insight into the depth and beauty of a particular song that otherwise might have faded from the public's ears. Today on Connections, we're joined by Adam Kubota, bassist for the hugely popular band Postmodern Jukebox. Formed by Scott Bradley in 2011, the big band has gone on to record numerous albums featuring today's hits yesterday, garnering 5.43 million subscribers to their YouTube videos and more than 1.7 billion views overall. The band will play the Kodak Center in Rochester on Tuesday, October 26th. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Hey, good to be here. Good to be on your NPR affiliate. Really, I love it.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you for being here. We'll be listening to a couple of Postmodern Jukebox covers alongside the original tunes shortly. I did, Adam, want to get your thoughts on songs by other artists as well, in order to just sort of get into the discussion about cover songs and why they matter.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Let's go for it.
Okay, cool.
Dive in.
So we just heard an excerpt of Where Did You Sleep Last Night, a folk song recorded by the legendary blues musician Lead Belly in 1944.
Lead Belly.
Yes. And while it's a seminal recording, it wasn't exactly well known among fans of popular music in the 90s. Kurt Cobain of the grunge band Nirvana had never listened to the music of Lead Belly. That is, until he caught an interview with William Burroughs in which the Naked Lunch author had said, "These new rock and roll kids should just throw away their guitars and listen to something with real soul like Lead Belly." Nirvana's version of the song would eventually appear on the 93 live album MTV Unplugged in New York. Here is Cobain's interpretation in what became arguably the most iconic performance of his career.
I'm going where the cold wind blows. In the pines where the sun don't ever shine. I will shiver the whole night through.
So Scott, we just heard obviously two very different versions. The cover is certainly recognizable as coming from the source material. Yeah, just wondering what your thoughts are to about that particular cover, and perhaps, you know, extrapolating to your thoughts about covers in general and how you approach them.
Yes, of course. Just to clarify, just I am not Scott Bradley.
Oh,
I'm
I misspoke, Adam. I appreciate
make sure you didn't. All good.
I
mean, his name is on the marquee for sure. So I mean, you know, covers are, you know, they're nothing new under the sun. I mean, you know, I just always think about, you know, the fact that I like learned to be a jazz musician, and especially when you learn all those standards, especially, I mean, so, you know, so much of it is about learning songs of, like, you know, the Great American Songbook, you know, Tin Pan Alley, all that stuff. So, and a lot of that stuff was written for Broadway, and a lot of the jazz musicians, I know, like the Ellingtons, the Basies, the Benny Goodmans, I mean, they actually helped make those songs more popular by, you know, reinterpreting it, you know, sort of fleshing it out with, like, different, you know, with, like, the sound of jazz or the sound of the big band. So they did it in a way that is so creative. And I've been reading this book about the Great American Songbook. A lot of the composers were actually a little bit resentful of some of the interpretation. So it's a complex, multi-layered thing for sure. But I just think that anywhere where there's space for a lot of really amazing creativity, in terms of, like, arrangements and covers, I think that you're going to get some really, really good products. In terms of that, I know both of those tracks, the Lead Belly one and you know, being a 90s kid, I definitely listened to a lot. I remember that Nirvana Unplugged, and then he actually talks about the Lead Belly estate. Somebody from the Lead Belly estate tried to sell him Lead Belly's guitar for, like, you know, $200,000 or something. Like, he says that on the actual recording, which I think is always sticks out in my head. But there's a lot of complexity there, definitely in terms of, like, socially, the history of our country for sure. But if you look at, like, it's an amazing song, very, very, like, memorable, profound. I mean, Lead Belly is such, like, a iconic, yeah, you know, originator of this, of a, like, a really beautiful folk song tradition that's sort of based on, like, of, like, angst and, like, paranoia and sadness, right? And then, right, if you kind of look at, like, somebody like Kurt Cobain, I mean, it's like you can use all of those words to describe, like, what he was feeling in his life and his sort of tortured psyche, but he's also, yes, you know, a creative genius, you know,
yeah,
like Lead Belly, but he's just like, he listened to that stuff and he, it resonated with him. And then he, you know, he felt like he had something to say with it and made something really creative. And he also gave props to Lead Belly to make sure that he was, like, letting people know, like,
right,
who wrote the song. So in my book, in my personal opinion, you know, and people are, you know, totally welcome to disagree with me. Like, that's a pretty cool interpretation and a great homage to Lead Belly, because I think a lot of people wouldn't even, you know, might not even know who Lead, yeah, Belly was.
Yeah, that is key. I think what you said about the fact that Cobain really made sure to acknowledge where his version came from is super important, because that way you're not falling into the trap of appropriation or just otherwise ignoring the history of the song and giving it the due respect it deserves. I would agree with you that, you know, about that interpretation of the song as compared to the original, it definitely is true to it. I think one thing that I notice is that I feel like the Cobain's cover really kind of brings to the fore in a really visceral way the emotion that's just beneath, that's kind of a little bit more under the surface with Lead Belly's version, which itself was a cover. Lead Belly didn't write that tune, of course, but so it's interesting to keep that in mind as well. I did want to ask you,
okay,
specifically, Adam, about the Postmodern Jukebox, before we get, yeah, into an excerpt of an original and then a Postmodern Jukebox version. Do you find that with audiences? Yep. Are you there?
Sorry, yeah, I just blew my Bluetooth little ear pod just fell out, but it's back.
All right, great. So, yeah. do you find that the audiences were somewhat sort of reticent or had reservations about postmodern jukebox's approach to songs, the idea that you could take pop radio hits, the kind of music that perhaps people who like jazz age music and big band music from back in the day wouldn't necessarily, you know, those same audiences wouldn't necessarily listen to songs by the Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears or Outkast, for example. So did you find that it was difficult to kind of bring them along, or?
I mean, I actually find that to be like the opposite. I think that the way that Postmodern Jukebox does it, just in terms of like, you know, Scott's really great and very, very creative arrangements, and sort of he always kind of goes out of his way to sort of flip the expectations of the song on its head and sort of just create a new way of thinking about the actual source song, source intellectual property. And then like kind of combine that with like, just like the vibe, the type of performers that we bring in that are so, you know, dynamic. They love the new songs, but they're so steeped in like some of the more traditional, you know, art forms, musical art forms of this country, that it's like, you know, it's like even people like myself who might not be like super up on, I don't know, let's say back in the day when we were first doing it, like I wouldn't really be that up on a Nicki Minaj song, you know, in like 2012, I wasn't really like, you know, Nicki wasn't in my playlist, but then, or Bieber, you know, Bieber wasn't really in my wheelhouse back then, but I was like, I actually kind of like enjoy like some of those songs on their own right now. So I think it's actually a powerful way to bring in new fans to like to a certain, artist's, repertoire, just through people like kind of just having a positive association with the melody and the content of the lyrics. Yeah. So I think that actually PMJ does do a good job. We have won people over just in terms of, you know, artists and songs that people might not have been into. And just also just like the idea of covers in general. But I mean, like, as I said before, like covers are nothing new, but it's like, I think that maybe we have like a sort of a negative stigma on them, because you might think of like, you know, just like maybe you think of like the worst version of where a band just does like these really, really sort of terrible, just straight covers of bands. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like where they just basically just try to copy the original, and or maybe like dress up like those guys, and they do a bad job of it. You know what I mean? Like we've all seen that, you know? And I mean, I actually kind of enjoy that, you know, but then you take it like all the way over, like, you know, across the whole spectrum of like using somebody else's songs, using their art, their IP to like, to do something totally different and like magnificent. Right. I mean, you could even think of like like a Aaron Copland, you know, Appalachian Spring or something like that, you know,
right.
Like you're taking songs and you're reinterpreting them, giving them new life and new meaning, and this just like an infinite amount of just great creativity that can like come through that process. But maybe like in our, you know, world, we're kind of just, when we think of covers, you know, you think of it as just like maybe this like one thing, where it's actually like a pretty huge genre encompassing like jazz reinterpretations, arrangements, you know, like reharmonizations, like all those things. That's like so cool. I just saw Robert Glasper play at the Telluride Jazz Festival, and he did a version of In Rainbows. And I was like floored by how great it was. Like it was just like one of the coolest things I had seen in years.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool when you get a cover like that, where like it seems totally out of the blue, performed by an artist who you wouldn't necessarily associate with Radiohead or that particular album. And case in point, I want to turn to a cover, an original and a cover, subsequent cover that Postmodern Jukebox did. Talk about a connection that nobody necessarily was making before you guys did. I want to play a short excerpt of Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again. And then right after that, we'll hear Postmodern Jukebox's version with Adam Kubota, on bass.
I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. Oh, baby, it might seem like a crush, but it doesn't mean that I'm serious. Cause to lose all my senses, that is just so typically me. Oh,
okay, so there's the original. Now we're going to hear Postmodern Jukebox's revamping of Oops, I Did It Again. Adam, I'd love to get your thoughts on that song and the process and anything that comes to mind for you.
I mean, number one is like such a timeless song. I was just thinking about how, like, you know, in like that last sort of like late 90s period, you know, that just that Britney, you know, vibe. She was just like, you know, it's like really, you know, talented, attractive, you know, you know, young girl, and she's just like, you know, and she's working it, you know, like, and that's the vibe they're trying to create. But like, then you listen to it in this like 1930s, sort of sound. And it was somebody that has like, you know, like more like kind of jazzy vocal, you know, like, aspect to their voice. And it's like, it's sort of like flawless. Like you really could, like, if you were like digging through like a old, you know, antique store, and you found like some old, you know, like an old record or something like that, like you could really put that song on just about and you know, and believe that it could have been through that, you know, through from that period. The song really, really works. And it's just like, I don't know, everything, but there's so much. I mean, I think just what Haley is doing with her voice, Haley Reinhardt is a fantastic singer that, you know, on that one. And I've been really fortunate to work with her a bunch of times. She's just putting so much stuff on it. You know what I mean? She's just like, she does so much with her voice. You know, you could tell she's listening to some, you know, some jazz and some blues, and she's really like cop that stuff, but she also loves the song, you know? So she can be in both worlds at the same time and put all that, those like melismas, you know, in her voice and those little different things she does, like sort of tonally, texturally with her voice, and just really like just evoke like a whole different vibe through the vehicle of the song. Yeah. And then Scott's putting all this other harmony, you know, it's like a somewhat static harmonic song, as a lot of pop songs are. And there's a lot of creativity involved in actually creating some motion and some harmonies that are, you know, into like a more complex version than the original. And with organic instruments, as opposed to what you're hearing in the original recording, which is a lot of like more like drum beat, you know, kind of stuff. Everything's real, you know, I mean, it's like to click and to, you know, it's, I mean, I'm sure some of those are not, you know, actual instruments.
Yeah. I really like what you pointed out about vocalist Haley Reinhardt's approach, the way that, and what I noticed too, I'm basically, this is essentially what you were saying, but the way that she manipulates the timbre of her voice at certain words, certain phrases, to really sort of dig into the lyrical content and the emotional content of the song, and kind of, you know, ham it up a little bit too, obviously, like it's meant to be fun. And that really comes across. I wanted to, for those of you who just tuned in the last few minutes and wondering boy, why is Connections playing Britney Spears and Nirvana and all of that? Well, today we are listening to cover songs and talking about why they matter, and also what it truly takes for an artist to make a cover song their own. I did want to, before we turn back to more excerpts and more into the conversation, I wanted to turn to some listener emails. We've gotten a great response from you all telling us about your favorite covers and why they're so resonant with you. Michelle in Rochester writes, "One of my favorite covers is Sound of Silence by Disturbed. Acoustically, it's great, but I think an element of why I like it so much also has to do with experiencing the music video, the visual contrast between Simon and Garfunkel, and the multiply pierced lead singer. I believe his name is Aaron Lewis. Anyway, that's interesting too. Yeah, when that, you know, that version of Sound of Silence really takes a different, almost more sobering kind of tact, and it brings a real gravity to it, the fact that it's being performed by this hard rock band Disturbed, albeit in more of a ballad format. But that also brings up another point, is that, you know, covers, well-placed covers that are really faithfully performed by people who love the original music, can really elevate a song and bring it back into the consciousness of the public. And I think that's what Postmodern Jukebox really succeeds so well at doing. By the way, Postmodern Jukebox, I should mention again, is playing in Rochester at the Kodak Center on October 26th. You can go to the Kodak Center's events page for more information about that show. Adam, I'd like to kind mm-hmm. of dig into some more music, actually. I want to dig into a song that you and Postmodern Jukebox have covered. We're going to listen to the original and a different version by actually a local Rochester artist by the name of Danielle Ponder. But I would love to get your thoughts after we hear both those clips and to talk about this particular song. We're going to hear an excerpt from the original version of Creep by Radiohead, and then we're going to hear a different version by Rochester's Danielle Ponder. But I'm a creep. I'm a loner. What the hell am I doing here? I don't belong here. I don't care if you know. I wanna have control. Perfect body. I want a perfect soul. And I'm a creep. Oh, I'm a weirdo. I wanna have control. I want a perfect body. I want a perfect soul. Thank you. right. We just heard Creep performed by vocalist Danielle Ponder and pianist Avis Reese. Adam, I'd love to get your thoughts not only on the cover that we just heard, but how it might relate to Postmodern Jukebox's own take on the Radiohead classic.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, that cover sounds so awesome. I mean, it's just like, you know, Danielle has such a really, like, powerful, like, you know, haunting voice, like, and she's really, like, kind of getting the, like, the vibe of, like, what this song, again, we're kind of just dealing with, like, with angst and, like, and sadness, and the piano playing is really, really fantastic as well. And the contrast between the style of the vocals, you know, dripping with all this really nice reverb too, by the way, and the piano playing, which is like really evokes some like sort of like pop, but also like with classical influences, like, you know, maybe some Rachmaninoff or maybe some like Beethoven piano sonatas in there. And I just think that is like such a cool version, and I haven't heard that version, and so many people have done this cover, so I think that's definitely a very, very strong one.
Yeah.
And I mean, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna didn't mean to interrupt you, but I did just want to ask you, I'm sure you're about to tell us about a little bit about how your band Postmodern Jukebox approached Creep, and what I wonder what if there were any particular challenges to going about it and really making it sing in the band's collective voice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that just to give the history of like that cover, you know, there's a version, the first PMJ version to check out there is the one with a singer that we work with in New York named Karen Marie. And that version is the first version I play with PMJ. And I know that came from a collaboration that they did at some point, and that's where it came from. But I think that that song worked really well as sort of a, I think not many people were covering that, you know, that song, particular song, as much during that period. Definitely not in the sort of like the vintage throwback style. So like, I think that it, in addition to it being a great song, you know, performed by a great vocalist, arranged by like a great arranger, it was the right thing, the right execution by like high level people at the right time. And I just think that there was a real big appetite for that. And when you start with a song that everybody like kind of knows, it's all in our consciousness, you know, and you really can execute like a great change on it, interpretation. It just like people just notice and they love it, you know? And I think that like, you know, Danielle Ponder's version is also, it's just like a super, like very, very like well executed version, but it'll see if you like think back to like some of the like Brad Meldow recordings from like a while back where he started playing like, you know, Paranoid Android and like, you know, all those like different, you know, different versions, like with this modern jazz feel, like it just hadn't been done. And we all knew those songs. We all grew up with those songs. So when those records came out where Brad and Jorge and Larry were like playing those, you know, playing those versions. And it was like, it just, as someone who was like a young jazz nerd, like I couldn't stop listening to it, you know, cause it was just, I was like, why didn't you think of doing that song? You know?
Yeah. And you also bring to mind for me, obviously, pianist Christopher O'Reilly, whose covers of Radiohead, as well as covers of artists such as Nick Drake and others, were really influential, particularly the Radiohead songs, for a lot of people, myself included. This is Connections. We're talking to Adam Kubota of Postmodern Jukebox about cover songs and why they're important and why they're often amazing and really revelatory. We're about to take the only break of the hour. When we come back, we'd like to open it up for your calls as well. If you're interested in talking to us about your favorite covers and why they're important to you, you can reach us at 263-9994. Or through the 800 number 844-295-TALK. And we look forward to hearing from you, and we'll be back after the break with more Connections.
On the next Connections, how much of a right do you have to privacy at work? What happens if your employer finds things that maybe they didn't want you saying in your emails or your text messages? We'll take on that topic in our first hour. Then in our second hour, conversation about depression. So many of us are suffering from it. What's out there to help you cope? I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. Lots to talk about Friday on Connections. Join me.
All right, we are back on Connections. I'm Daniel Kushner filling in for Evan Dawson. And as I mentioned before, we are here with Postmodern Jukebox's bassist, Adam Kubota, listening to original songs and cover versions and just having fun and, yeah, talking music. Thanks again for joining us. This is really great, Adam.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad I'm doing a good job.
Sure thing. So let's head right into some more music. I want to listen to Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes. And then right after that, I want to listen to Postmodern Jukebox's version of that as well. So, and then we'll come back after the break after that and talk about it. I mean, there is a lot going on there in that cover by Postmodern Jukebox of Seven Nation Army,
yeah,
originally performed by the White Stripes. Adam, break it down for us a little bit, if you will.
Good. I feel like I'm doing like the play-by-play of like a basketball game or something like that.
Yeah, I love it.
But yeah, I mean, again, you picked another great version by Haley. I mean, you know, again, she's just doing that, all that stuff. Great stuff she does with her voice, you know. I mean, she's just like such a present performer, and like she's just right there, you know, with the lyrics, and she's got so much control and so much like soul and, you know, blues in her voice and jazz, and she's just like really just painting the words, you know, painting the lyrics, you know, with the great lyrics, you know, by the White Stripes. I don't like really know like the history of that song. I assume Jack White wrote it. And it's just like this sort of, I don't exactly even know what the song is. It just seems like a dude who's like about to like, you know, bust out like a Seven Nation Army of like, you know, of trying to whoop on somebody. And he's just driven to do that. You know, it's always interesting when you kind of juxtapose like the person who's seeing it, you know, and it's Haley, you know, like a, you know, like a young lady, you know, sing the lyrics and, you know, instead of like, you know, instead of Jack White. Also, it's like something to pick up on a lot of that stuff is like, well, I mean, like the White Stripes stuff, there's, I mean, Jack is so deep into studio, you know, production and effects and all those like different, you know, great things you can do in the studio to make a song and add some textures in there, which is really is like complete symphony unto itself. You know, that I love that kind of stuff. And then when we do PMJ, things are just so much, we don't have that. We don't use those types of techniques, like no, you know, no effects, no heavy reverbs, you know, obviously no auto tunes. So it's like we have to achieve that effect, you know, with something different, which is like the instrumentation and you know Scott, you know, filling in some of those some really nice fills between some of the phrases there. The other thing too is like rhythmically, when you hear some of the songs, you kind of want to hear about like how the rhythms are treated, because you know, like White Seven Nation Army is like da 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 da, it's straight. The rhythms are all straight, you know, but when we play it on stage with PMJ, it's like da 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 da, you know, you're just taking that tradition, that bluesy, jazzy African-American tradition of swinging some of the rhythms.
Right.
And so you kind of got to hear, like, listen about how that's like part of the art is like how you treat some of those issues when you don't have these studio elements, you know, you don't have, you know, you don't have, you know, you change the rhythmic elements. Like, how are they artfully doing that in a way that makes it work? I mean, some songs probably just wouldn't work if you had to swing it or you didn't have like, you know, crazy studio effects or something like that, you know?
Right. I'm really glad you mentioned that rhythmically, that just simple approach that is so fundamental to performing jazz, big band, swing songs, you know, swinging, playing with that rhythm and taking it out of that straight, you know, straight quarter note feel a little bit and straight eighth note feel and just kind of playing with it really opens up the expressive possibilities for musicians such as yourself and Haley Reinhart to really do their thing. I wanted to, we got an email from Nick in Fairport who says, love me some PMJ, and mentions that Tom Jones has a great take on covers. He says, he's paraphrasing here, but the quote goes, you don't say to Sir Laurence Olivier after watching him perform Shakespeare, that was great, but did you write it? So that was kind of a fun way of looking at it. The fact that, you know, just because you're performing a song by someone else doesn't mean that is inherently less valuable. In fact, you know, jazz and classical traditions, as we've been talking about, are really steeped in the importance of new people coming in and interpreting these iconic and classic or perhaps less well-known songs or compositions. So I think that's really great. Adam.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. I also have an email here from Jane who mentions she mentions Joe Cocker's cover of With a Little Help from My Friends, of course, the original by the Beatles. Yeah, I would definitely put that up there. She also mentions Placebo's cover of Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill. And Kate Bush is one of those artists that's really fascinating, obviously really enigmatic, doesn't necessarily perform very often or put out that much music. But when she does, it's amazing and hugely influential. I mean, I know that a few years back now, vocalist Theo Blackman devoted an entire album to Kate Bush covers. And he's another one of those artists that is just really great at transforming songs. In fact, we're not going to be able to listen to it today, but my favorite, one of my favorite covers of all time is actually a cover of the Velvet Underground song Heroin. And it was arranged by the composer David Lang and sung by Theo Blackman. And it is just so haunting and a completely different approach. For those of you who are listening and are interested in checking that out, I highly recommend it. There's that. Adam, I have another question for you. When you're looking to perform a cover of a song, are there certain things in your that you want to keep top of mind, or is there certain values when it comes to the music that you feel are like indispensable to really being able to internalize a song, get the gist of it, the emotional crux of what's happening, and then being able to translate that into a version that also includes your own ideas and your own creativity?
Yeah. I think that's a tough one, because I think that like really the sky's the limit in terms of like, you know, like the emotional experience of lyrics is so subjective for each person. Everyone's, you know, emotional landscape is so different, and the words impact them, you know, them differently. I go out of my way to listen to, you know, even, you know, this stage of my life, just listening to the lyrics a little bit harder than I was, because I was such like a jazz, you know, nerd, and just always trying to like learn the, you know, always listening to the chord progressions and the rhythms and stuff. And I'm like, okay, actually the hierarchy for me, when I'm playing with singers like PMJ, the hierarchy is the vocal first, and everything else needs to serve that, you know? So that's the way I'm thinking about it. But I just think like in terms of like, you know, doing like an arrangement or a cover, I mean, you can really like, I probably could think of some like really weird, interesting like versions that just really like distill it down to like a really just its most recognizable broad stroke form. Yet it's like, it's still a cover, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like there's like a version of Heroes, David Bowie's Heroes, and I think it was arranged by Philip Glass.
Oh, you know? Right. And yeah, it's like, he did a whole symphony inspired by,
yeah,
by that work. That's a really good example. I don't mean to cut you short, Adam, but I did want to just mention once again that Postmodern Jukebox, the band that Adam Kubota is a part of, is going to be playing Rochester on October 26th at Kodak Center, this is just a great conversation. It would be remiss of me to have a conversation with you about cover songs and not include the song Hallelujah, of course, originally written and performed by Leonard Cohen, the late Leonard Cohen. It came off of his Various Positions album in 1984, which wasn't even originally released in the U.S., interestingly enough, and then really, you know, many people have covered it. Weirdly, Pentatonix have kind of made it a Christmas song, which I find wholly inappropriate, but that's for another conversation. But I will say that we're going to listen to an excerpt of the original version, as well as the iconic, totally transcendent version by Jeff Buckley, who for my money is my favorite vocalist, just period. Passed away way too young, obviously. I just want to read a brief quote from Leonard Cohen, as quoted in Alan Light's book, The Holier the Broken. Hallelujah is a Hebrew word which means glory to the Lord. The song explains that many kinds of hallelujahs do exist. I say all the perfect and broken hallelujahs have an equal value. It's a desire to affirm my faith in life, not in some formal religious way, but with enthusiasm, with emotion.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing.
It goes goes like this: the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. And she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew.
So we just heard first Leonard Cohen's original, Hallelujah, and then Jeff Buckley's cover, which appeared on his 1994 studio album, Grace. I did want to include Jeff Buckley's thoughts on the song as recorded in Alan Light's book. He says, "Whoever listens carefully to Hallelujah will discover that it is a song about sex, about love, about life on earth. The Hallelujah is not an homage to a worshipped person, idol, or God, but the Hallelujah of the orgasm. It's an ode to life and love." And I, Adam, I think you really hear, you know, two different versions. By the time Cohen wrote and recorded that song in 84, he was already, you know, in well into the middle age of his life. And it kind of has a little bit, you know, a kind of a wise sort of perspective to it, whereas Jeff Buckley's version is really that of a young man, which he was, of course. And it really are two very striking perspectives, and yet they're both the same exact song. Do you have any thoughts on what we just heard?
I actually was thinking it'd be interesting to hear what Leonard Cohen thought about Jeff Buckley's version. I think that would be the interesting commentary, is about like how the artist, the songwriter thinks of like a great cover, or if they have any sort of like, you know, like applause, or if they, or if they're, or resent, or like you messed it up. But I mean, that song is just really, I didn't really think of the interpretation of the song in that way as Jeff has said it. I just always, the lyrics are so just provocative and colorful and interesting, and even includes a little music theory in there. So
yeah,
but it's just like, you know, it just, there's something about that song that just works, and it's sort of like a hymn to existing, you know, to like being a human being. And I think that's what translates so well. And I love both those versions, you know, tremendously. And I'm sitting in the theater in Easton, Pennsylvania, before one of our shows. And I was just like swaying, you know, especially when the Jeff Buckley version came on. And so it's very emotional. It can definitely, that song is a song that can get you in the tear ducts for sure, if you're in the right mind state, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. I actually just heard word from, a producer of ours, Rob, who is keen to mention to us that Leonard Cohen has in fact called Jeff Buckley's version his favorite. So that is good to know. And makes sense, I think, probably to me, and it sounds like it to you as well. Another thing that's interesting about the song Hallelujah, which I learned from reading Alan Light's book, The Holier the Broken, is that Cohen actually had written over 100 different verses to that song. And so in his version on Various Positions, there are two additional verses that don't show up on Jeff Buckley's version. And they really are interesting, and also kind of address the potential sort of sacrilege that he's performing by using all these loaded biblical references. You know, the one verse says, "You say I took the name in vain. I don't even know the name. But if I did, well, really, what's it to you? There's a blaze of light in every word. It doesn't matter which you heard, the holy or the broken, hallelujah." And I think that that's a really profound verse, but also can be extended to how we think about covers. You know, it doesn't matter which version you heard, the holy version, the broken version, the pop version from the early 2000s, or the retro 30s take on it. It's all worthwhile music. And yeah, it's really exciting. Thank
hallelujah.
You.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, hallelujah. I want to thank Adam Kubota once again for joining us. He's the bassist of Postmodern Jukebox. They'll be playing October 26th in Rochester. Thank you again, Adam. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much. And I hope to see some of the listeners out at the show at the Kodak Center. We played there before. It's fantastic. You know, some of our band members went to Eastman, and the whole show is just going to be, I mean, it's just, it's not just a sit-down concert. It's like it's a get-up. You know, we have a tap dancer. We have a horn section. People get up and swing dance, so it'll be good.
Awesome. Thanks again, Adam. This has been Connections. I'm Daniel Kushner filling in for Evan Dawson. Have a great day. Oh!